The question, as you may have guessed so far, is question for the morning. What would it be like if God spoke to you? And not only that, not only just what would the experience be like, how would it sound, what would his voice ring or resonate in our ears, what would that be like? But even more than that, what would he say? Maybe it's appropriate on a Father's Day weekend like this is to use a couple of Father's Day kind of ish examples. And just, you know, this doesn't apply to any of you dads out there, just talking for myself. Sometimes it takes one or two requests for something to sink in. You know, never more than one or two, right? But sometimes it takes a little bit more than a subtle hint here and there, or a glare, or a nice note, or a honey-do list. Sometimes it takes like email after email to finally sink in. I'm sure that wouldn't happen to any of you, but for the rest of us in the room, there are a time, true story, when it takes a little bit more than that. When my wife and I, Kristen, who's exceedingly generous and gracious and forgiving, when we first got together, got married, we had a small apartment with a coffee table in the middle of the living room in front of a patio slider, and the sun would shine in at about 6:30 every night. The sun was just at the right angle. You could see like the beam of speckles of dust onto the coffee table. It was almost like divinely illuminated, where you could see the coffee table was always dusty, no matter when it was most recently dusted. It like came that way. And she would make a comment at 6:30 every night to saying, like, it's dusty again. I cannot believe it's dusty again. And after a little while, being the newlywed that I was, I figured out she might be trying to tell me something. So one day she gets home from work, and I say, guess what? What? I did something. Was it expensive? Like, what did you? No. I dusted. She's duly impressed, I can see, and she starts looking around the apartment and going, did you dust the bookshelf? I forgot to dust the bookshelf. Okay, next time, you know, I missed the, did you dust the TV stand? I forgot that too, but, you know, the baseboards, did you wipe down anything? And it kind of clicks that for me, it's like cleaning is picked up. For her, it's picked up, disinfected, sanitized, and like wiped down and everything. So, okay, you know, I forgot a few things, but, you know, I dusted. And she asked in this most generous tone that she could, Dirk, what did you dust? I said, the coffee table. It's done. That's not dusting, Dirk. And she kind of showed me a little bit more else that has to be done. It took one or two tries after 8 years, starting to get a hold of it here. And she stuck with me. Isn't that nice? What happens, though, when the comment isn't so subtle over and over and over a long period of time? What happens when someone just breaks into your life, interrupts whatever's going on, whatever mundane thing that you're working on, and speaks so loud, so clear that you have no doubt both who it's coming from and what they're saying? In the biblical book of Exodus, we have that exact story where God breaks into the life of Moses and demonstrates completely, 100% sure, we know that it's God, because of what happens. And it gets weird. Stick with me as we read, just doing this passage a few verses at a time, because it'll take a bit to get through here, and then wrap up with a few comments about somehow how it applies to our week ahead. From Exodus chapter 3, words are on the screen behind me. We have the first few verses. Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. Good Father's Day weekend passage here. Taking care of the sheep. That's what we do, the priests of Midian. And he led the flock, curious passage, to the far side of the wilderness. Or desert, wilderness or desert, could be either one. I mean, it's just, isn't that odd that Moses takes his dad-in-law's sheep and brings them through the desert to the far side? I mean, it's the desert. You don't want to be in there for too long. It's like the ancient equivalent of commuting from here to Indiana for work. And it's like, and that's just kind of what happens. Odd. Well, hang on to that. And he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I'll go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Change that. And Moses said, here I am? Because he didn't really know what in the world was going on, did he? He's never seen a burning bush before. He's definitely not seen a burning bush that was on fire and didn't burn up. It was a strange sight, right? In his own words, as he goes over there, he didn't know what was about to happen. Because foliage, trees, shrubs, plants of any kind simply don't burn and then not burn up. Lots of ways you could get into that, and you could explain away some of these causes because they have some kind of a natural root to it. So, somehow it wasn't quite so miraculous, but it was just something that happened. The temptation is alive and well all through. And you look at a story like this, and the explanations are many. One of person says that, maybe there was a natural gas, like this hold right underneath a shallow natural gas pocket that burst open, and then it started on fire, and that was right behind the bush, and Moses got confused seeing the two of them front and back, and he thought that the bush was on fire when in fact it wasn't. Kind of a stretch, but then it gets more creative. The next one says, okay, well, there's a kind of plant in the ancient Near East called a dictamnus plant that it emits this volatile flammable gas as it, you know, breathes photosynthesis, etc. And when it's possible in the desert that it could spontaneously combust and like, you know, like starting your grill after, you know, pushing like the button and it's not going, you can smell the gas, and it'll probably be fine. And then it goes. My brother just lost his knuckle hair last weekend, which same thing, which is kind of funny that both he has knuckle hair and now he doesn't. But anyway, problem is, Moses looks, and the plant is unique because it's covered in this oil and leaves that though the flowers and the buds would flame up and almost disappear, the branches and the leaves do not because they're covered in that oil. So Moses seems to have an entire conversation with God while this thing is still burning in the background, so it doesn't quite make sense. The most creative explanation away that I have to hand it to this cognitive psychologist at the Hebrew University said, there are a hallucinogenic plants growing around that same time period in that same area that could have been used for religious rituals. Perhaps Moses had ingested some of those and thought he saw a bush burning that didn't burn up. The author kind of goes on in the paper to admit that there's really no grounds or rationale for that other than the plants do seem to have existed at one point. There's all of these explanations as to maybe it's not so miraculous. Maybe it is sort of a natural occurrence, although a rare one. And there's that way all throughout Scripture, this temptation to sort of explain it away. I share this with you this morning because the series that we're moving into right now is on the book of Exodus, and we're calling it the Supernatural Exodus. It's just our way of saying, listen, there are just crazy things that happen in this book, just bizarre and miraculous things, and we can be tempted to explain them away, but at the end of the day, it's the God who breaks in, who created the natural order, breaks into the natural order, interrupts it, and does something to grab our attention. Bushes, foliage, shrubs of any kind do not burn and not burn up. Gnats do not form out of the dust. Flies, frogs, locusts do not invade nations. Rivers do not turn into blood, the plagues, which we'll get to. Rocks do not spew out an endless amount of water from within them. People, this is a big one, people do not come back to life from the dead. Unless God acts. And isn't that exactly what gives us hope? So we do not try to explain away these bizarre occurrences. We just try to figure out how it is that God is trying to get our attention. And we do that by seeing how he tries to get Moses' attention. You know how long he was going to Horeb? Going to the far side of the wilderness? He had spent 40 years taking his dad-in-law's sheep through the far side of the wilderness to graze over here. You know what I call 40 years? You know what I call when you do the same thing over and over and over again for 40 years, and it's your livelihood, it's what you do? It's a career, friends. 40 years he does this thing. I mean, this is about the time that most people would think about calling it quits, passing it on to somebody else. Maybe have a kid who can take over taking the sheep over there to the far side of the wilderness. After doing this for 40 years, God breaks in. I can't imagine what would he's going through his mind at a time like this when he's just trying to wind things down, and God seems to be telling him to wind things up. 40 years later of doing this, God breaks in and says, I'm making good on my promise. I'm making good on my promise to take my people, the Israelites, who were oppressed in the land of Egypt, and I'm making good on my promise to lead them out to a place of their own. And Moses, I'm making good on my promise through you. So take off your shoes, son, because this is holy ground. I'm giving you the instructions. I'm choosing you. One might think that he would be a little excited to receive such a word. One might think that he would be a little proud to be the one handpicked by God to make good on a centuries-old promise. Everybody knew the promise. Everybody's waiting for the promise. Everybody's waiting for the one to come along. Except when Moses hears the words, he isn't elated. He isn't proud. He's a bit hesitant. And in fact, he could almost come across as pouting, like a toddler who is told to pick up his room. He's less than excited. Pick it up here in verse 10 of chapter 3, where God says, so now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? It's a good question, by the way. It's a good question when he asked God back, you want me to do this, you picked me to make good on your promise, who am I? He's got kind of this twofold response going here. It's a comment about himself, but it's also a comment about how he's going to be received. He'll get to that in one of the five objections that he makes. It's a good question, who am I? Because if the Israelite people knew anything about Moses, they'd know one or more of three things. First of all, that Moses, though born an Israelite, wasn't raised by an Israelite family. He was one of us, but he wasn't really one of us. In fact, even worse than that, he was raised by the royal family, by Pharaoh himself and his court. He's one of us, but he isn't really one of us. They might also know that Moses got himself into a little bit of trouble. He committed an atrocity, in fact. He saw an Egyptian oppressing an Israelite, and he went and he murdered that Egyptian. He hid the body, tries to cover it up, only it didn't stay covered for long. People found out about it. People found out that Moses was a murderer, and when they found that out, number three, he took off and he fled. So when Moses asked God, I mean, who am I to be the one to lead the people out? It's a good question because the people knew that number one, he was one of us. He wasn't one of us, though. He was a murderer, and he was on the lam. He was running. He was fleeing. This is like the last person that you would expect God to come in, break into his life, and say, listen, you're my guy. It's a good question when he says, who am I? But God says this exceedingly clever response. Verse 12, I will be with you. I will be with you. Hang on to that. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God here at this mountain. This place you've been coming to day in and day out for 40 years, Horeb. It's going to go by a different name. At some point, we'll start calling it Sinai. And here on this mountain, I'm going to tell you and all of you, the entire people, that as long as you come to me, I'll be there for you. The commandments given at Sinai, the Ten Commandments, the one on stone. That's where it happens. This plain old place that he's been coming to have his sheep's graze for 40 years. This is the place. Come here when everybody comes across. I'm going to make a deal, a contract, a covenant with you that you'll be my people. I'll be your God forever and ever. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what's his name? Then what should I tell them? God says to Moses, I am who I am. In a lot of versions of the Bible, when you look at that, it's in all caps, I am who I am. In the script is smaller, as if to set something apart, to say that there's something interesting going on, something unique. In fact, it's not just saying I am who I am as a casual sentence. It's set apart because it's a title, it's a name, like John or Frank or Susan or Bob. In this case, I am, the word, is Yahweh. It's a clever play on words, like I said, in God's first answer, because he says up in verse 12, when God says, don't worry, who am I? Don't worry, I will be with you. That also, by the way, is the same version of the word, only not a name this time. I will be, I am, it's all the same word in their own language, but he says the I am, the I will be, is with you. Say to the Israelites, I am, has sent me to you. It's the first time in the text, it's the first time in the biblical story that God shares his name with the people. You'd think it might have come a bit sooner in the story. We make it 100 pages or so in before we hear the name, but there it is, I am. Only a small problem with it is that we don't actually know how the name is pronounced. Some people call it Yahweh, other people call it Yahweh. Guesses are all over. The reason is because when it was written down, the language was written down without vowels, save space, right? It was only consonants. Words are kind of difficult to pronounce with just consonants. If I'm going to say my name, without a vowel, it's hard and you don't really understand. So of course we need vowels, the A, E, I, O, and U, the sounds to fill it in, the breath, the air. And everybody just knew what the rules were until some of these generations started dying out and new languages were learned, the languages of the nations around them, and people couldn't speak anymore. So a long time later, they went through and they put all of the vowels in all of the letters so they would know just how to pronounce all of the words. Only they felt it was the name, I am, was so sacred that they didn't want to speak the name, they didn't want to write the name if they didn't have to. And so without filling in those vowels, because that would be considered disrespectful to their God, they put in vowels of a different word on top of that one. They put in vowels of the word for like master or sir or lord, like a title, mister kind of thing. They put Adonai is the word. They put those vowels on top of this word. So when they came to it in the reading, they wouldn't accidentally pronounce the name and then cause disrespect of the household for him to God. Instead, they would trigger, oh yeah, I'm supposed to say Adonai when I came to the word that clearly isn't. I was in a Hebrew class with one of his Jewish student who grew up this way. It was very bizarre. I couldn't figure out what he was doing. It was explained to me, and I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. I think I'll share that with somebody someday. One more comment on that. If you look at the word I am in Hebrew, Yahweh, sometimes it's pronounced, and then you take those vowels of Adonai and you put it in there, the technical name for the word that becomes is gibberish. It's nothing. It's not a word. It doesn't mean anything. It's just the consonants of one word and the vowels to get together so they can avoid saying the word. Consequently, how you pronounce that is Jehovah, the nonsense word. Some people have taken it a little literally. Amy Grant comes out with a song, and it sticks around. The point is that the I am is with Moses. The I will be, the ever-present God of creation, is near him, goes before him and behind him, protects him, and as we'll see, gives him the words to say. Moses, taking all of this in, and even more, comes up with another objection in chapter 4, verse 1, where he says, "What if they don't believe me or listen to me and say, 'The Lord did not appear to you'?" Then the Lord said to him, "What's in your hand?" "A staff," he replied. He's a shepherd. He has a staff. It's not unusual. It's like a carpenter who has a hammer. You just sort of expect it. The Lord said, "Throw it on the ground." Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake. And he ran from it. Moses is such a great leader. I love picturing him like running away from the snake on the ground. But then the Lord said to him, "Reach out your hand." This is a big ask, by the way. Then the Lord said to him, "Reach out your hand, take it by the tail." So Moses, who just ran from it, reaches out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hands. "This," said the Lord, "is that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you." Why is that so? I mean, it's crazy. It's miraculous. It's amazing. We know that, a staff turning into a snake. But on top of that, there's another layer of significance that would have meant something to a people living in Egypt. When you imagine an Egyptian pharaoh, like whether it's the cartoon version or an actual like picture of King Tut or something, he's usually wearing a crown with a little like cobra in the front of it. You kind of like know what I'm talking about? That makes sense? Like four people are nodding, but that's what it is, right? Like picture it. The snake was the Egyptian national symbol, like a bald eagle, only way more than that because they put way more meaning onto it. So like the snake was everything. So the significance of turning a staff into a snake, saying, "Look what I can do," and then taking it back and turning it into a staff. It's like the national symbol of, I can toy with this, I can mess around with this. This image of something so fearsome, so fear-heavy, I can manipulate and distort. If I can do that with your symbol, couldn't I do that with you, Egyptians, as a people? That's the significance of it. Then the Lord said in verse 6, "Put your hand inside your cloak." So Moses put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, the skin was leprous, diseased. It had become as white as snow. "Now, put it back in your cloak," he said. So Moses put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. It's a symbol of what was unclean becomes clean again. This is a repeated refrain throughout the people of Israel, living in lands, mixing up with people that they're not supposed to mix up with beliefs that they're not supposed to mix up with, getting clean and then getting unclean again. Then the Lord said, "If they do not believe you or pay attention to the first sign, they may believe the second sign. But if they do not believe these two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile, pour it over the dry ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground." Nile River, they didn't believe ever had an ending. They believe it just went on and on forever. And in fact, it was so stable, and so rarely did it flood over the banks of what they knew it would week in or year in and year out, that it was an image of life. And it contributed, probably the most significant contribution to what Egypt became, the superpower that it did, was the stability of the river of life that they believed it was. And blood, obviously, just the opposite of that. Anything to strike terror in their hearts. Verse 10, again, an objection. Moses said to the Lord, "Pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past, nor since you have spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue," or in literal, "I am heavy or dull of mouth and tongue." The Lord said to him, "Who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I? The Lord, the I Am? Now go, I'll help you speak, and I'll teach you what to say." By the way, all of these good objections. Sometimes we see Israelites as complainers in the wilderness. And maybe they were. Sometimes we can see Moses as just frustrated with his people, and maybe he was. Here we can see Moses offering up objection, objection, objection. Four in a row here so far, just saying, listen, God, you have the wrong guy. Do you remember what's in my background? There's no way they're going to believe me. Like, why are they? Okay, we've got these signs. We've got you with me. God, I don't even speak well. I mean, you know, I have this this impediment. You know, maybe he has a stutter. Other people say that maybe he had a he lost the diplomatic tongue that he was raised with in the court of Pharaoh. You know, doing the blue collar stuff for 40 years in a row. Other people say maybe he forgot the language Egyptian. Ooh, whatever it is, God, you got the right guy. I can't even speak well to the chief guy of the land, the Pharaoh. Objection, objection, objection. Notice something. So far, God has not voiced a disappointment or disgust in return. Notice something. After he says, listen, God, no, you don't understand. You got the wrong guy for 1, 2, 3, 4 reasons so far. I'm not cut out for this. So far, God never gets angry, gets upset, gets impatient. He just offers an answer, offers an answer. They're never going to believe me. Tell them the I am is with him. God, they're never going to believe me unless here's a sign. In fact, here's three signs. The staff, the cloak, hand thing, the river, blood deal. 1, 2. They're never going to, I don't speak well. Don't worry about that. Isn't it me who gave you speech in the first place? Do we have to revisit the staff thing again? Do you think a stutter is going to be an issue here? I mean, come on. God simply answers the request along the line, until he gets to his final objection. In verse 13, but Moses said, pardon your servant, Lord, please send someone else. No more good reasons, no more sound objections, no more reasonable reasons why he's not the guy. And then in verse 14, but the Lord's anger burned against Moses. And he said, what about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak well, and he's already on his way to meet with you, and his heart will be glad when he sees you. I'll make sure of that. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak and teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. And then this, like, revisiting the staff. But take the staff in your hand so you can perform the signs with it. It's a weird story. And there's dropping, like, along the way, there's, like, these breadcrumbs that just bizarre little things, like, I will be, and then also, hey, by the way, that's my name. I am, I will be, the Yahweh, the one who is and will be. There's this staff, kind of like this repeated refrain throughout the story. There's this 40 years of going to the same mundane place for no apparent reason, Horeb. I said the theme of the morning, if we could put that on it, was this question. What if God spoke to you? You know, what would it sound like? What would that be like? And then what would he say? I almost hesitate, you know, to do this because there isn't a formula to it. But if there's not a formula, there might be a pattern to just how the interactions with how God picks his people and speaks to them. And you look at, you know, the next one was after Moses was Joshua. And you know the calling or when God got in touch with Joshua, it wasn't a burning bush. It wasn't just something incredible and amazing. It was just, hey, Joshua, you're the number two. Moses is gone now. He died. You're not one. The I am will be with you. I will be with you. I am with you. And that's it. It's just this boring few lines, and then they get on with the mission. You know, after that, there's this story of Gideon, which almost lays on top of Moses' perfectly, and there's this calling of Gideon where he asks Gideon to do something, right, to save them from the Midianites. And Gideon says, I don't know about this. I need a sign. He breaks in while Midian is threshing his father-in-law's wheat. which is kind of a fun coincidence. So there's Samuel, who's at night, and he's sleeping, and he keeps hearing, "Samuel, Samuel," and he keeps getting up. And it takes like a half dozen times for him to realize, I think maybe this is God trying to get a hold of me, trying to grab my attention. If we're looking for some kind of a takeaway or application for this week of what would it be like for God to get a hold of you, to break into your life, I think the first thing we have to say is whatever your week looks like, and chances are it's probably going to look a lot like last week and the one before and the one before that. In fact, you could have a 40-year history of doing the same thing and just winding down the career when God breaks in, when God initiates the conversation, when God, I love as Pastor Brian put it this morning, when God speaks the first word, because that's what he does, that's who he is. It speaks the first word in our lives, in our spiritual lives, speaks the first word in our hearts to get them going. What would it be like for God to break into you? Well, first of all, he's probably going to come to you. We can do what we can to find him out. But again, as Brian said, and I wish we could say that we planned this whole thing so perfectly, but honestly, I think God just says the same thing to two different people sometime. But the difference between Christianity and everything else is that God comes to us first, is that while we're still sinners, God died. This isn't a system about trying to reach back to him. It's about God interrupting. And the second one is God interrupting the mundane. I wonder how many times in 40 years he saw that same bush. Never thought of it, because one bush is exactly like 100 bushes, right? As he walked by the far side of the wilderness, and he never noticed anything out of the ordinary with this bush, like it was potentially flammable in a way that wouldn't burn up. Of course, I don't think there was anything significant about that bush. You probably don't either. Moses didn't either. Until God did something incredible with it. You drive by the same place, the same building, every day, and you never realize this is the place that God is going to break into your life in an incredible way. Nothing to do with that building. Everything to do with what God is going to do with you at that building, with that building. God speaks first. He speaks through the mundane. It's fun that Gideon is threshing wheat. You know, like the ancient equivalent of working on a metal stamping line. Just over, 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 over. The same thing day in and day out when God speaks into him. Just like Moses with the sheep. Over, 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 over. When God speaks in, breaks into his life as he's winding down a career and starts it right back up again. And then we have this odd thing about arguing back and forth with God. He's not the only one. Jeremiah has some objections about whether or not he's cut out to speak. Samuel has some objections. Isaiah has some objections about speaking as well. Every time God says, understand. He doesn't get angry at the objections, which I find fascinating. He's patient with the objections until he's just outright told, listen, I'm not going to do this. That's when he, you know, gets things moving, so to speak. It's almost as if offering up the objection is a way of qualifying somebody. You know, like, if you think of yourself so highly, maybe you're not the right person. It's this odd paradox of how life with God works. Only those who would never be considered. When you tell yourself this week, there's no way that God would ever be asking me to do that. I'm just the last person. Now we're getting somewhere. Now you're right on deck, as you say in baseball. Of course, there was one who never put up an objection. Not a clear objection, no. He argued a little, but he never demanded a sign like the rest did. He argued a little when he was in the garden and he knew the death that lied ahead of him, and he prayed, God, take this off my plate. Take this cup from me. He knew what was coming up when he was on the cross hanging there, and he said, God, why did you leave me out in the cold like this? God, why have you abandoned me? God, why have you forsaken me? The objections were there, but the need for a sign wasn't, because he knew. He knew who was talking to him, and he was so accustomed to the voice, he knew what that God was saying. So what's he saying to you about this week? What's the burning bush that you drive by every day, and it's there that he's going to grab your attention? He might not be asking you to be a missionary and traverse the globe. He might simply be asking you to be a missionary and traverse the lawn or the cubicle. And Father's Day weekend, as a lot of us spend time with family, he might not be asking you to be a great reconciliator of nations, but someone who brings your own family together again on Father's Day. Whatever he's saying, we can say this with utter certainty, is that whatever you face this week and next, the I Am is with you.